I suspect we'll get started. A small but intimate team. Now, I've been asked at the outset to encourage questions. As someone who has been to a lot of AGMs in my time, I know that sometimes standing up at a microphone can be confronting, and it's somewhat deliberate from some companies, but there's plenty of room for you to make your way out there. It's another trick of AGMs. And there's no spotlight on you, which is the third trick to discourage conversation. All right, my name's Stuart Wilson. I am the ESG manager at SunSuper, but I have a broad accountability, one of which is the co-PM of our multi-asset strategy we call our strategic partnership groups. But today is not about me, it's about Greg Cooper. He's the star of the show. Greg is the CEO of Schroders Australia and has been since 2006. He has worked extensively throughout Asia, particularly Japanese equities, and is the former head of actuarial and consulting at Towers Perrin. Greg's been described to me as one of the gentlemen of the industry and a real statesman. But one of the things that I like about him is that he is able to challenge the status quo and conventional thinking, and I expect he will do so today as well. So I hope it's an informative and lively discussion. We should have some time for questions, but without further ado, I'll hand over to Greg.
Great, thanks. All right, well, I'm glad it's not a book launch, otherwise I'd be rethinking my career, but I guess sort of two things about today. Firstly, you know, in terms of what I wanted to cover, this session was originally myself and Michael Blaney, and Michael Blaney was going to talk a bit more about the how, and I was largely going to focus on the why we need to think differently in investment terms. Because Michael ended up doing another session earlier in the day, then I've gotten the mantle for all of today. So I've included a little bit of thinking on the way through here about some of what we do and how we think, particularly around implementation of these sorts of strategies. But I'm certainly happy to take, you know, questions both on the way through, actually, given the size of the audience, but also when we get to the end of the session, around the how exactly does one think about implementing and running the sorts of portfolios or the concepts behind the portfolios that I'm talking about today. But I suppose the real premise about what I want to talk about here is really twofold. So firstly, what is it about our current way of thinking around investments that is fundamentally flawed? And therefore, how should we rethink our approach to that? Now, I did have a number of poll questions, and I won't necessarily embarrass you by asking you to go into the app and try and figure that out. But some of the work that we've done was to look at, well, if we followed the construct behind portfolios in the way that you know, we traditionally approach them, what are the sorts of outcomes that we would get? And what sort of degree of confidence should we have in our ability to continue to deliver those outcomes? So what we did was we said, well, let's take a traditional kind of 60-40, 70-30 portfolio. Let's run that back through history. And let's go, well, what sort of outcomes did we get from that? And that portfolio gave us an annualised real return of about 5.3% over the last sort of 115 years from which we've got Australian data. But if we take that portfolio and go, all right, well, I want to assume that I, with 90% confidence, I'm going to be able to tell my members that this is the sort of outcome that you'll get. And if my target behind that, following that sort of very traditional approach, was CPI plus 5, the reality is I need about 85 years worth of that historical data in order to generate my 90% confidence. And even if I lower it to CPI plus 4, something many funds, you know, if I roll the clock back sort of 5 or 6 years ago, a lot of funds in their PDSs had targets that were sort of CPI plus 5 or close to that. And over the last few years, these have been progressively eased back. But even with a target of CPI plus 4 and using that historical period that is already predisposed to being a pretty positive investing period, I still need some 53 years in order to be able to say with 90% confidence, I'm going to be able to deliver you that sort of outcome. And that's clearly, I guess, sort of the time frames that are significantly longer than what most of us would anticipate. I suppose by the time we get to CPI plus 4, you could argue 50 years, you know, certainly if we throw in a bit of longevity, we're all going to be working into our 70s. There's not going to be an age pension to rely on, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe we will have close to 50 years of investing, albeit I'll touch on in the second part about this, about some other issues that why we don't necessarily have the sorts of time periods we think we have. But in any case, you know, it's still a very long period of time in order to generate, you know, what most of us would regard as kind of an unexpected outcome. So the question that I had in terms of the straw poll was, well, if I then said, well, you know, thinking more realistically about the typical investor, and I think it's rare that we would go to a new 20-year-old joining our fund and say, hey, don't worry, next 53 years you're going to earn CPI plus 4. The reality is most people have significantly shorter time frames than that. What are the sorts of numbers, using the traditional construct of portfolios, that we would be able to offer an investor with that same degree of confidence? So I said I won't embarrass such a small audience by asking for the poll, but you know, we had our sort of 85 and 53 years for CPI plus 5 and 4. If we flip that around and said, well, all right, you know, what's the best I could offer over 40 years? So there's, I guess, the more traditional sort of 20, 25 to age 60, sort of 65 type frame. Then the numbers actually start to drop considerably. The best I could offer is actually 2.6% real. Over 20 years, we fall to 2.1% real. Even those sorts of timeframes are obviously quite long timeframes, and I suspect many of the members of super funds, or certainly those receiving advice, don't really sit there and say, this is my 20-year goal. You know, timeframes that are 10 years or even shorter are probably more realistic sort of areas of focus. And the reality is, if I follow that 60-40, 70-30 type sort of traditional approach, then the best that I could offer on a 10-year time frame with 90% confidence is inflation minus 0.8. So you can imagine that the sort of conversation that we should be having with a traditional investor who's coming into a balanced fund is, look, don't worry, 10 years, I'm 90% confident that I won't lose more than 0.8% of your money per annum in real terms. You know, it's hardly the greatest sort of, you know, conversation to have with investors. And, you know, the reality behind all that is because the way in which we go about framing that traditional approach is based on some incredibly, you know, flawed, frankly, assumptions about the way investing works. You know, we look here, this is just, you know, using that same data set but actually showing you what the underlying sort of rolling 10-year returns look like through time. So this is all sort of based in real terms. The green line here is the average through time, which, as I said, is about 5.3%. But what you can see there is that rolling 10-year returns historically, we've gone through periods that are exceptionally good, and then also through some other periods that are exceptionally poor. And while we can sit there and go, well, you know, this was the 70s and we had, you know, sort of incredibly high inflation, et cetera, you know, we had, you know, issues around sort of the Great Depression and World War II and everything here, the reality is actually these events do happen, and asset markets are cyclical. They do go through these sorts of periods. You know, we were somewhat lucky during the sort of the GFC period that here, that while 10-year returns fell somewhat, you know, the actions of central banks to come in and pump up asset prices, you know, somewhat saved those rolling numbers. But it doesn't negate the fact that this is an enormously volatile series. And a time frame like 10 years, you know, most people would regard as a sufficiently long one to start to smooth out some of that variability. And the reality is actually with our traditional approach, it just doesn't work. And the reason why is, you know, we're all familiar with the sort of the, I'm sure we're all familiar with the traditional kind of CAPM type approach. You know, we have our you know, efficient portfolio. We have our capital asset allocation line. You know, the traditional 70-30 portfolio kind of sits out here somewhere, notionally efficient. We've all sort of built these models that, you know, expected returns and standard deviation numbers, and we put them in and we confuse our clients and say, hey, this is a really efficient portfolio looking forward. We've gone sort of the next step and built, you know, life cycle portfolios, which are really just a collection of other, you know, portfolios that sit along that same efficient frontier line. And, you know, the idea being that we might migrate down these portfolios in order to reduce risk over time. We've got concepts like risk parity portfolios that you know, take portfolios along this line and then gear them up to try and sort of move us above the line and create, you know, something that's going to give a better long-term return at similar or lower risk. But the reality about all of these things is they're all based on these same fundamental underlying assumptions that, you know, there's a relationship between risk and return that over time will play out and will end up with, if we take a long enough period, this kind of, you know, traditional efficient frontier type picture. And that's, you know, that's what we got during the 1980s. You know, the period of time when, you know, a lot of us were at, you know, school, university, or in the early stages of our career, and in fact, you know, the superannuation industry was really just getting sort of kick-started, the efficient frontier was pretty much exactly how we thought it would be. We'd come out of this period of the 70s, everyone had forgotten about, you know, what happened to equities during that period. The 80s had started, and lo and behold, you know, the science and the academics all appeared to be right, and we got this sort of great efficient frontier. Unfortunately, as we roll forward through that period and we get to the 1990s and the 2000s, the reality is actually that curve looked, you know, completely different. The thing was, and this is, you know, you can, you know, prove anything with statistics really if you like, but, you know, if you look at obviously the scale on that chart on the y-axis there, you know, it's a very, very tight scale. So in all reality, if I plotted this on the same scale as this one, even though it would be somewhat lower, it would look almost like a straight line. So, you know, it wasn't disastrous, the 90s and the 2000s. The reality is actually was, you know, that, you know, bonds had a better return than equity at lower risk, but only just. So the model still worked. It's just that it wasn't so much that, you know, we wanted to have more in equities to generate the return and a bit in bonds to dampen the volatility. The reality of the 90s and the 2000s was it didn't matter. Could have done whatever you liked in asset allocation terms. The reality is both asset classes gave us broadly the same thing. So, you know, we might have been wrong, but being wrong didn't hurt.
The biggest bond market rally in 500 years.
Well, precisely. So, you know, starting from this position, and that's something I'll touch on a little bit, you know, maybe the outlook looking forward isn't going to be quite so benign from that perspective. But, you know, and this is what, you know, people, you know, board actuaries do in their spare time, but one of the things I did do is say, well, let's just look at that efficient frontier sort of back through time and see just how stable it was. I mean, I had obviously sort of 2 points in time there, the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. Here what I've done was actually just go, well, let's just roll it forward every month, kind of starting in the 1930s, and just see how stable that curve is. Now, hopefully the... oops, no, that's not going to work. Maybe I'll try it on here. No. Oh, there you go. My home video isn't going to work by the look of it. No. Worked on the one outside, but anyway... well, look, I suppose, you know, if I do get around to playing this, you know, what you see is that the efficient frontier basically just jumps around all over the place. And this is a 10-year time frame, so it's not like I'm using, you know, sort of a 1 year or 2 year, you know, actual sort of, you know, risk and return profile. This is 10 years. And it, you know, it goes inverted, it goes around, it goes higher, it goes lower, it is literally all over the place. So the idea that somehow that efficient frontier, that primary basis on which we've based the traditional portfolio, holds over any kind of reasonable time period is frankly fundamentally flawed. So that's really, I guess, the first part about today is the you know, the underlying premise of the way we invest is frankly wrong. The second thing, and I suppose the other issue, and it's one I had another sort of poll question on, but we'll skip over that again given the size of the audience. But Yeah, the other thing here that we don't often talk about in our industry is path dependency. Mm. Now, a typical investor, we sort of frame the way we present all of our data largely because it's difficult to do it any other way. But a lot of the framing around which we present data is based on time-weighted returns. And the thing about time-weighted returns is they assume that you've got constant capital. So I might have, had a pretty healthy return from, investing in any sort of traditional balance type structure over the last sort of 15 or 20 years. But all the numbers that I see that come out of that have this underlying assumption that I basically had a dollar invested constantly through that period of time. The reality is that the way our savings cycle work is for most of us, we're not lucky enough to be a Warren Buffett where we've got this tremendous source of capital that we're never going to draw down on. We have to save money during our working career and then gradually draw it down through the end of that. So we have a process of building up capital and then drawing down from that capital. And the issue is, and this often gets talked about. Sorry, Melinda, I'm going to pick on life cycle portfolios a little bit here. If we think about, sort of the idea that, in the first 20 years, say, of a savings career, we could either get an additional 1% return or we could put additional 1% contribution in. The reality is actually the impact of both of those two decisions is broadly identical. It makes no difference really what we do in the first 20 years of our savings career. So, part of the idea behind life cycle, we can afford to take more risk when we're younger, and we absolutely can afford to take more risk when we're younger. It's just the reality is actually it doesn't really matter because, we've got so little capital invested during that time frame. Whether we invest in 100% equities or 100% bonds really doesn't have a particularly large bearing on the outcome. Where all this does start to matter, though, is when we get into the latter parts of our saving and investing period. And here, the difference between making an additional 1%, additional contributions or being able to earn an additional 1% return is quite stark. The 1% increase in earning rate has about 8 times the impact of my 1% additional contribution. And the same thing happens if I then go from, I've taken the 40-year savings, period here, and then I look at, what happens when I get to the drawdown phase in the retirement period? And, that first 10 years of retirement, it's pretty critical what I get in terms of investment return. As that period kind of lengthens, then actually it's the drawdown rate that starts to have a much bigger impact. And that's fairly obvious. As my capital, my sort of corpus gradually reduces in size, the impact of an earning rate change isn't really that great, but the impact of a contribution rate change or a drawdown rate change is significantly greater. But again, unfortunately, the way we kind of frame most of our investment materials and our decision making and so forth is to assume that there's not some terrible difference between people in these different stages of the cycle, and that ultimately actually just the return you get is a time weighted one, when the reality is actually it's far different from that. Clearly when I've got far more capital invested at much later in my saving cycle, what I get in both in terms of upside and downside has a significantly greater bearing on my ability to be able to draw down. So those two issues around, one, the approach we use and this idea that a 60-40 or a 70-30 sort of strategic portfolio, which is frankly the bedrock of the industry, will, one, generate a sort of reasonably good outcomes over suitable time horizons, is fundamentally flawed. And obviously, if we then overlay on top of that this concept of path dependency and the fact that actually my time horizon really isn't as long as I thought it was. I don't really have a 40-year savings cycle. Even in this simplified example, I've got a 20-year savings cycle because it's far more important that latter 20 years than the first 20 years. So my time horizons aren't really long enough to be able to make, even if I did believe in that sort of traditional framework model outcomes work, my time horizons really can't be long enough to make that happen.
So Greg, on that slide, yep. On the first 20 years, so the contributions to me look like they do have an impact. It's 8% because you invest in early, you've got the opportunity to compound. But later on, the investment returns are really swamping the result. But yeah, it's still important that people are contributing early over the 20-year period.
It is, and I mean, but obviously the way most of us frame, you know, or the way most people think about savings in retirement is they tend to save far more in this period as they approach retirement. That's when they increase contribution rates and everything else than they really do in this period.
And then the last stage, that's when you de-risk. If people are taking their growth away, so they can't earn those returns.
That's right. You know, and so it's quite critical here that if we start to de-risk, you know, that's the point when actually. So what, you know, if you think about the typical member, what we do is we kind of ignore them in this period, which is fine because it doesn't really matter. But then when we get to this period, we say, hey, why don't you increase your contribution rate and we'll do things to your investment return that reduce it.
You've still got 30 years at that point.
You do, and yeah, particularly you take that next 10 years of drawdown. So our whole sort of, you know, framing with members when we have those conversations is fundamentally the wrong way around. You know, it's, as I said, it's, you know, I'd be worried less about putting more in and worried more about the way in which we frame the investment decision and what they can do around that, because an additional bit of return is going to have far more impact than what they can do in terms of additional contributions. Yeah, obviously. That's oversimplifying. I mean, you've got more certainty about a 1% contribution rate than you do about a 1%, you know, sort of generating a 1% investment return in addition. But nonetheless, we tend to forget about this part or try and de-risk them here and focus more on, sorry, the other way around, try and de-risk them, you know, on the earning rate and focus more on trying to beef up the contribution when it can have, by definition, less impact. You know, one of the, and I'm not sure this one's going to work either, but, you know, obviously part of the issue here is return and risk forecasts and how they might move through time. So, you know, one of the things that we've done here, which is say these are really just, you'll never be able to read them, but the blue dots represent equities. The green dots are kind of your lower risk, more defensive asset classes, and the yellow dots there are things like, you know, EM debt and the like. And was really just to look at if we go through time, how do risk and return kind of forecasts change? I'll attempt one more go, but I suspect. There we go. This one's going to work. You know, so this is just, as I said, sort of taking us through time, and it's really, and sort of started back in about 1998. This chart. And you see, you know, we're rolling forward sort of month by month, so you can't really see that down there. But 2007, we're about to hit the GFC. You know, all of a sudden our return expectations went, you know, sort of quite high for a bit. But you see, but you know, broadly, these things move around quite a lot. And the problem with, you know, and certainly as we've gone into the latter period, you know, we're now at a point where expected returns on most asset classes are fairly low, you know, and in particular on some of the more defensive asset classes are indeed negative. You know, you've got negative rates of return effectively on, you know, a number of government bond markets around the world, particularly in real terms. So, you know, the reality is actually, you know, we don't take account of that massively changing framework, you know, if we just stick to this more traditional idea behind, you know, how we might construct our 70-30, sort of 60-40 type portfolio. So if we think about, you know, sort of the way in which we might approach things, you know, we tend to sort of, you know, we should be focusing a lot more on those things that are going to necessarily impact outcomes. And I'll touch on this sort of when we come back to it in the end about where we should be sort of placing our time and effort. But I guess a lot of the constraints that we have are sort of really represented down here, and particularly the peer risk, you know, the surveys, the business risk type issues, you know, to my mind, probably over-dominate the way in which we go about framing the investment decision in our industry to the detriment of, you know, trying to do the best outcomes by members. Because the more we focus on those, you know, business, peer, reputational risks, which are all relative risks, and less on terms of, you know, things that might, you know, actually generate a better outcome for members, then the worse the aggregate, you know, the worse the aggregate for members. I was going to just touch on implementation a little bit. You know, it seems to be the you know, particularly from our perspective when we go out and talk to clients and in more sort of investment focused forums. You know, the implementation to us is the thing that everyone seems to be focused on at the moment. And what can I do to improve implementation? And You know, concepts such as smart beta and factor investing, about whether we use passive investing, less institutional, but certainly more in the, you know, SMSF and the retail space, you know, whether we might use ETFs. These are just kind of representations of interest, if you like, just sort of Google search terms. And you can see, you know, I think in particular, you know, these concepts of smart beta and factor investing that frankly didn't exist 5 or 6 years ago have suddenly become quite prominent in the investment industry. And they are, frankly, just, you know, different thought processes and different ways to go about trying to solve the implementation problem, and generally trying to solve it with, you know, the minimum fee applied. So fees have been a pretty heavy driver of some of these issues. You know, certainly in the industry fund space, you know, illiquid assets have really taken prominence over the last few years. We've seen a substantial rise in any form of illiquid asset, probably partly driven by the fact that, you know, real bond yields are getting lower, and you know, maybe the argument that we sort of often hear is, well, you know, I don't want to have too much duration in my bond portfolio. I'm not really getting paid for it, so I'll remove my fixed income assets and I'll go and buy this really long-dated, heavy duration asset over here because I'm worried about duration and interest rate. That doesn't really make much sense to us, but nonetheless, that's kind of the... obviously I'm paraphrasing, but to me that's kind of the argument of sort of chasing sort of, you know, illiquid assets. I mean, obviously they come with other optical benefits such as, you know, notionally lower volatility and all those things, which are all fantastic until you actually have to sell one and then you suddenly realise that, you know, they aren't as stable as what you thought they were. But I think, you know, these are all just sort of, you know, people trying to think through different ways to solve the implementation problem, but don't necessarily change the fundamentals of the way we go about sort of solving the broader investment problem, except probably this one to some extent, where it is, in many respects, actually somewhat detrimental, because I think what you have seen over certainly the last few years, and you can see this just by looking at quite simply the MySuper allocations, is a real drive down in terms of defensive assets and a substantial rise in terms of growth type assets, including illiquid assets, which we would put at the higher growth end of the spectrum, or the higher risk end of the spectrum, not necessarily always high growth. But certainly over the last few years, they are
classifying them with respect to the whole growth defensive, and there's no uniform way of doing this.
Well, I think that's what people...
Is it completely meaningless anyway these days, given these sorts of assets have quite different
characteristics? Yeah. Well, part of it's trying to game the system. You know, clearly if I put more in my defensive bucket, the more growth I can put in my defensive bucket in a period when growth has done relatively well, then I look better in my particular peer group segment. Yeah. So, you know, sorry not to be completely cynical about the process, but I suspect that...
No, I wish I could get some of it in my
portfolio. Yeah. you know, obviously for the retail funds, it's been somewhat harder to do some of that. But you know, to us, that's, you know, there's you know, there's clearly some risks that are associated with that, particularly in terms of driving up your aggregate growth asset exposure at a time when growth asset returns have been, or prospective returns are actually falling.
But if you're an industry fund and you've got a default super tap always on, it's a pretty low risk strategy.
Well,
like that, I would have thought, and you've got a smooth return,
It sounds intuitively appealing, and certainly, you know, at an aggregate fund level, if I think about, you know, I've got this constant flow of funds that I can use to apply to these, so I don't really have a liquidity issue.
Yeah.
You know, obviously MTAA found out sort of slightly to their detriment in 2008 that doesn't always hold, and while not everyone's going to take sort of the same degree...
Yeah, they were very extreme.
They were right out the far end of the curve, you know. Things can still change, and the reality is for an individual member, you know, thinking about a new member joining tomorrow or an older member who's sort of been there for a while, do I really want, you know, their own portfolio isn't necessarily as you know, you wouldn't invest individually in a way that might represent some of this. So I think there are some broader issues here, and certainly if we saw, you know, all these things work wonderfully well when markets kind of are nice and kind to us, you know, the minute they're not, actually that's when some of these problems, and I think, you know, the risk hasn't gone away. You know, and notionally what this suggests is that if I can if I can reduce my defensive kind of liquid asset exposure at the expense of putting more into illiquids, that suggests to me that risk has probably gone away and I can afford to do that. The reality is risk hasn't really gone away. So,
I think there's a myth that because investor behaviour doesn't change and because the industry funds have got a very strong cash flow and a very high default, members in the default option, then you have a stable cash base. But the problem is the more the profit the member segment starts to look like a fully fledged financial institution, it's not the 80% of members who are default that's going to be a problem. It's going to be when 5% switch out and you have a fair valuation problem. So you don't even necessarily have to get this massive shift from everyone moving away from the default. You only need to get 5% who want to shift on an asset that you can't transparently value, and you've actually got
Issues always appear in financial markets at the margin. It's always the everything's driven by the marginal investor, and when the marginal investor wants to start to shift, that's when problems will get created. When you look at things in aggregate terms, they often, the total asset size and the total cash flow size doesn't look that bad, but when you start to look at, well, what's the marginal investor doing? The marginal investor is the one who drives prices. That's when issues can pop up. Just sort of following on from that, obviously, this is just sort of looking at, if we spend too much of a focus on implementation, what you've got here is just, some of the major asset classes, and you can see from, these sort of candlestick type charts, the best performer, the worst performer, and sort of where most people were. The reality is actually, again, the asset class that I chose mattered far more than being the best or the worst in any particular of these asset classes. That was sort of encompassing the GFC period, so unsurprisingly, some pretty wide ranges there. But even in more normal periods, you still get largely the same effects. And it's not to say that implementation is unimportant. It still matters. But it is not the big picture decision. And it is certainly where we seem to spend, certainly from, my 30-odd years of experience in this industry, the vast bulk of our time from an investment perspective is focused on the implementation part of the question, which is, as I said, the least impactful of them. I thought I'd just touch on a little bit sort of, the way we've been thinking about this, and when we think about implementation, what are the things that we're trying to solve for? We sort of divide it up into these broad buckets, access, how easy it is to get your exposure in the first place to a particular. It's great. Yeah, you can have all the best investment ideas you like, but if you can't actually get access to them quickly and easily, then they're not much use. So access, we pay a lot of attention to. Obviously, what's the potential for alpha? Diversity, and I don't mean gender here, I mean proper investment diversification, and how much diversity is there in the underlying bucket that I'm looking at. What are the governance issues that surround it, and how efficient broadly is it in terms of making investments? And if I kind of just split up the way we think about it, we do use, we're an active manager, so obviously I'm horribly biased and think that everyone should be completely and utterly active and there's no place for passive. We do actually use passive and factor-based exposures when we're constructing these portfolios. We just, to some extent, think about them in these terms of what sorts of characteristics they deliver, but also recognise that that's not ultimately the problem. They're important, but only important at the margin. Even thinking about alpha, passive, you can still get, an alpha contribution, just depending on, you're not going to get it from a stock selection relative to the index that you're passively replicating, but you can still get it in terms of the way you might play for relative value trades or, from making your asset allocation calls. Factor exposures, have embedded alpha in. I'm not sure alpha is the right term here, but anyway, they have some sort of embedded exposure that we sometimes represent and call alpha. And obviously, active. I should put this under factor exposures too. Active exposures are obviously trying to get alpha, and it's certainly not a given, albeit nor is it in factor exposures. So these are some of the things that we try and sort of think about. And as I said, the way we build our portfolios is that we have bits of this, we have bits of this in certain situations, and we have bits of this. But the framework in which we're kind of looking at all of those is still the big picture macro framework around what are the exposures that we want, why do we want that exposure, what's the expected return that's likely to come from that exposure, and if we don't think that meets a certain hurdle, then let's not have the exposure in the first place, rather than worrying about too much whether we take it actively in a factor or a passive format. The big question is, do you actually want that exposure in the first place? And if it doesn't meet your return sort of hurdles or your risk criteria, then you're better off not having it at all, rather than necessarily taking it in a, you know, in a cheaper format or any other format. You know, clearly the other thing, and certainly if I was sort of just looking at markets at the moment, this is kind of the way we're framing, you know, our expected return and loss. You know, we think about probability of loss as risk rather than you know, volatility as the risk measure. You know, there is an implicit problem, as we said, sort of most asset classes, and it's just obvious we're sitting in Australia that we have a higher return on Australian equities. Australian equities have lagged broadly other asset classes, so, you know, of any of the equity sort of buckets out there, that's our kind of, and partly because of things like franking and stuff thrown in as well, about the only one. Yeah, well, it still survives for some, just not everyone. You know, about the only one that actually hits your CPI plus 5 target. So there is, you know, clearly an issue at the moment. And again, I'd come back to that point we were making about looking at what most funds are doing, and it has been a gradual increase in the amount of risk that they've been taking at a time when the reward from that risk is actually getting lower and lower. So it's a little bit counterintuitive as we've chased more and more return and sort of chased the peer groups and the and rankings in the tables, where we're gradually pushing funds out the risk curve at a time when that's probably not going to have the greatest payoff. The other way we like to frame things is just to say, well, what's the likely loss that I would get if there was a loss in any of these markets? And at the moment, you know, this is kind of a, you know, for the actors in the room, which I presume most of them are, sort of 95% conditional value at risk type framework. But, you know, the downside risks of asset classes are quite enormous. And so, you know, in many respects, you know, we're much more inclined to hold these highly defensive, highly liquid type assets at the moment. Because, you know, principally, you're not actually, you know, it almost doesn't matter what you own. You're not really getting much of a return pickup. But the potential downsides are significantly greater. So, you know, our view is we'd rather be at this end of the curve at the moment, you know, which is quite counterintuitive to where sort of certainly most of the industry has been going.
You're expecting assets to be more highly correlated given where we've come from, where we are at the moment?
To some extent, yes. Just because, you know, assets have been highly correlated on the way up. So it would be dangerous to expect that they're not going to be highly correlated on the way back down. And in fact, correlations across, I think, you know, we would, you know, one of our heads of equities who, you know, well, Martin Conlon would say there's only three asset classes. There's equities, bonds, and there's cash. You know, and what we've done is we like to carve all these things up into different buckets and pretend that they somehow might have different characteristics. The reality is actually, you know, things like infrastructure, you still either own the equity or the debt. You haven't suddenly created something out of nothing. And, you know, the issue at the moment is most of these assets have all been driven by the same underlying sort of fundamentals that we've seen from, you know, cheap money, basically. That's driven them all in one particular direction. So to expect that you're going to get some great degree of diversification from these in the future if there's an accident is probably unlikely in our view.
Almost every asset class in every country would be at an all-time record price.
It's pretty close, yep. Which is why, frankly, you know, for us, you know, we hold, when we run these portfolios ourselves, we're, you know, sitting on 35% cash at the moment, which, you know, to some degree sort of says, well, I'm not going to achieve my CPI plus 5 target. But frankly, our view is, well, not much else is going to get you there either. And I'd rather the optionality that comes from holding cash. And when everything's gone up, you know, we'll be sort of naturally contrarian and look to move away from those assets that have gone up rather than towards them. And again, sort of back to the point of this wasn't to talk about what we do, but the point of talk about, you know, that fundamental structural problem in the industry of a 70-30, 60-40 type portfolio, the reality, it just doesn't change. doesn't matter. You know, if you know, equities could be double their valuation this year relative to last year, and I'm still putting 70% of every new dollar into equities. I haven't adjusted the way I think about it. Whereas for a new member who's starting today or someone who's just transferred across, why would I want to do that with their money? It's not, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because the expected return's not there.
If you could wave a magic wand and change the way all the defaults of the funds are operating, what would you do?
We would change the framework around from to one of sort of outcomes orientated, and so we should only be talking in terms
of the individual members.
Yeah, outcomes.
The reality is, you know, you talked about the returns are much more important than contributions, but there's all the other stuff they can do, you know, around the decisions they make right across their super funds can have more. Those things can have more impact.
Yeah.
Like consolidating. You know,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. But I would particularly talk about, you know, because most funds have it in their PDS. You know, everyone says, oh, we target CPI plus, you know, now it's kind of like 3.5 seems to be the norm.
It's almost like we have to add a whole lot of extra dimensions on what we're doing, firstly in a default, but then in how we're engaging members through a process.
Yeah.
Stuff, right?
That's right. But no one even actually talks about really how they go about achieving that CPI plus 3, 4, or 5. You know, then it's all framed in, this is our benchmark and we've outperformed our benchmarks and we've added a bit here and we've lost a bit here.
And now it won't happen until after year 25, and then you've got insurance premiums coming out which stops the effect of any investment return. So like there's all these other dimensions to this.
That's exactly right. I'm getting the hurry up. I wanted to just touch on this and probably worth just finishing on this, but this is excuse me, a piece of work just to sort of say, well, you know, a lot of what we talked about, you know, you don't really have quite long data frames, you know, certainly in the context of someone saving through a 40-year career and then drawing down for another 30 years. You know, that's kind of a 70-year cycle, if you like, and if we're only looking at data sets that might sort of capture the last 110 years, there's not too many. Well, there's really only one data period that you can get that's independent of all the other data periods. One of the things I did was to look at and go, all right, well, where can we get much longer-term data? And just to look at the impact of different kind of investment approaches. And in going back to the UK, I can actually get, you know, 300-plus years' worth of equity and bond-type data. So what we did was construct sort of a couple of different models and say, well, let's have, you know, sort of four different ways of thinking about investing, from your traditional 60-40, all in equities, all in bonds, all this kind of just focusing on a particular outcome that's quite smooth through time, and then look at the variability. If I follow that investment process with a set contribution rate and drawdown rate types, or set contribution rate strategy, what would be the pension that I would have been able to pay by looking at, you know, every time period starting from the late 1600s, basically, and following that through? And what I get, if I follow a 60-40 approach, then, you know, my median outcome was something around the 45% of final salary, but, you know, variability from the high 20s into the mid 70s as a percentage of final salary. And obviously what stands out from that is, that is an enormously wide range of potential outcomes. So to say to someone today, you start saving, you follow this contribution rate, and by the way, you know, when you get to retirement, you'll either be, you know, incredibly well off or completely and utterly poor and relying on the age pension isn't really a good way to frame, you know, I think the superannuation, you know, the superannuation message. You could say, well, let's maybe if we put it all in equities, and what that did is it raised the median pension, but obviously made the range slightly wider. Interestingly, it didn't get much more downside from equity. So in the worst situations, being 100% in equities wasn't that worse than being in a 60-40 portfolio. If we were in bonds, then, you know, the median outcome fell substantially, you know, lower downside. But the thing about all these, massive range of outcomes. So by following those sort of more traditional fixed asset allocation processes through time, none of them really solved the pension problem that you know, superannuation or traditional kind of savings is meant to solve. If I turned it around, though, and said, well, what if I could just get a real return of 4.65%, and I framed the 4.65 to give me exactly the same median outcome as having 100% in equities, you know, unsurprisingly, I got a significantly lower range of outcomes, you know, the same median outcome as equities. But the real crux of all this is that the average return on a 100% equity portfolio was actually 75 basis points higher than my stable 4.65% real portfolio. So the reality is, you know, while this is not easy to deliver, you know, you can afford to pay, if you like, 75 basis points through time to reduce that volatility and get a massive reduction in the potential outcomes.
So you can kind of back solve to that, but how hard is it to deliver it?
Well, yeah, that's always the big question. How do you deliver a sort of a constant real outcome looking forward? And the problem is actually, and this is where we get back to time frames, you know, one needs to be conscious of the peer group type risks that, that come from that. So at times, and in fact, what I'll do is...
that'd be very different to everyone else.
This is kind of what it looked like in terms of asset allocation. So this was kind of my relative to 60-40. At times I needed to be, you know, almost 100% in equities, and at times I needed to be substantially lower than that.
But there's all these bots being created at the moment that you can program in parameters like that, and it'll just go and kind of, from a universe of managed funds, pick what's going to give you that exact return constraint or that. So it's interesting to see how we're going to signal.
But the driver behind all of those obviously has to be some input in terms of what your expected returns look like.
Yeah.
You know, and fundamentally, a lot of the work that we've done is just really simple measures like, you know, Shiller PEs and that kind of stuff are substantially better than following, you know, following those as a way of thinking about asset allocation gives you much more stable outcomes than following, you know, your traditional kind of 60-40 models. The problem is that there are periods of time, like the last 2 or 3 years, where asset prices just keep on going even though they're very expensive, and the peer group risk stuff becomes quite pertinent for that period of time. And that's where really as an industry, you know, to be able to deliver on the promise that we've made, we've kind of got to get away from this peer group type approach, which is what's driving us towards, or has been driving us towards that 60-40, 70-30, 80-20 and 90-10, I'd even say now, approach. So,
and I know working on these kind of products, the PDS is sometimes the most difficult bit. One of the attractions of your classic 70-30 is I can describe it really simply. So you have a simple description that gives a completely uncertain outcome. But in order to deliver a far more stable certain outcome, the description of what you're doing all of a sudden gets a lot more complex and a lot more difficult. And in some ways it feels like disclosure results in the tail wagging the dog.
There's definitely that, and there's definitely things like, you know, the way ASIC and APRA look at, you know, things like risk and risk modelling and all that kind of stuff drives it. But then, I mean, as an industry, we told them to do that. You know, they're just following what we've told them to do for the last sort of 20, 25 years. So I think it's partly us to kind of reframe that. You know. And I look at, you know, in fact, my dad, he's an engineer. He's retired. You know, he's got his money sitting in a balanced fund. The reality is he has no idea what a balanced fund actually means. You know, and if you said to most people, you know, tell me what this balance fund or this growth type fund really mean, they don't really have concept of that. They're just things that we overlay as an industry, and they're not terribly helpful for members anyway. Look, with that, I've probably better wrap it up there, given the bell keeps on ringing outside. So, thank you for coming.
Thank you.